It's Wednesday, February 17th. Everything's bigger in Texas, especially the power outages. We start here. With lives on the line, millions are asking, how did cold weather lead to an electrical catastrophe?
Texas has its actual own chunk of the electric grid.
Today, we're breaking down what went wrong and why the issues lie deep in the heart of the grid. They said you can't take an ex-president to impeachment court. He said, fine, I'll take him to regular court.
Lawyers could really try to unearth documents and emails, electronic communications.
With the Senate trial in the rearview mirror, members of Congress are pursuing new investigations to the assault on the Capitol. And it's like a jigsaw puzzle with a national treasure.
So the Americans rebuilt Notre Dame, essentially what they're saying.
Exactly.
Actually, it could be more like Jenga. Our reporter goes into Notre Dame to learn how difficult and dangerous it is to rebuild. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
We lost power last night and it trickled on and off probably 10 times.
When power goes off in a neighborhood, it can feel like an inconvenience.
Didn't have a chance to eat, didn't have a chance to brush my teeth or anything, so...
After a while, you start to worry about food staying good and how to see without lots of flashlights at night.
Three jackets, three pants, three socks and boots on. And
from there, every hour gets progressively more dangerous.
We haven't had power for the last day and a half. My house last night reached to 15 degrees inside. And it was horrible.
Which is why the power outages in Texas this week are so alarming.
We are following breaking news. Millions of people in Texas are without power right now as the state looks to conserve energy and relieve stress on the electric grid.
I'm 70 years old and I'm scared.
In Houston, a woman and an 8-year-old girl dying of carbon monoxide poisoning after a car was left running in a garage to help generate heat.
As of last night, more than 3 million Texans had lost power. That's like the entire country of Uruguay just turned the lights out. And the reason given to us was, you know, we got these ice storms. But what does that actually mean? We called up the senior science writer for our partners at 538. Maggie Kurth is here. Hey, Maggie.
Hi, how are you guys?
I'm doing good. So, I mean, intuitively, I get why a hurricane can knock out power to a place, right? Like, it makes the electricity poles come down, right? Like, the water causes short circuiting. But, like, freezing temperature, like, electricity still works in freezing temperatures. So why did this happen?
Well, power lines are still physical objects that can get damaged by cold, for one thing. So you have lots of different places in a electrical grid where cold weather can just take things down. And that is everything from an ice storm freezing the lines outside of your window and weighing them down to the point that they crash.
Two transformers exploded and was like fireworks going off.
Fourth of July.
That can mean the natural gas coming out of the ground at the production site is freezing up at, you know, at the site of production.
We're down there doing everything that we can to literally put heaters in the ground to get those lines heated back up.
That can mean, you know, people, workers at power plants not being able to drive to the power plants because it's just too icy. There's lots of different ways that weather of this extreme in a place that does not expect it to be that extreme can really just start messing with the entire system.
Right. And then the problem is the weather is causing the outages, but the weather is also causing the demand too. Like at that moment, people need their heaters on more than ever. They need medical services more than ever. Why Texas? Like Maggie, like we're seeing other power outages, but we're talking about 10,000, not 3 million. What happened in Texas?
Well, there's a number of different things happening here. And some of it has to go back to the fact that our electric grid is not a... It's not like a brand new state-of-the-art designed system anywhere in the United States. And one of the things that we're sort of seeing happening here with Texas is that Texas is like a whole other country.
In North America, there are three electric grids: the Western Interconnection, the Eastern Interconnection, and the ERCOT Interconnection.
Texas has its actual own chunk of the electric grid. Like the U.S. electric grid is divided into three parts: everything east of the Rocky Mountains, everything west of the Rocky Mountains, and Texas.
Wait, and literally, like Texas is on its own?
Literally, yes, yes, yeah. Like that, that's not even an exaggeration.
ERCOT's policy direction comes primarily from the Texas Public Utility Commission, guided by the Texas Legislature,
and it. is like that because of politics, basically. Like, there's no technical reason why it has to be that way. There's no reason why that's even remotely an ideal situation.
ERCOT is similar to an air traffic controller. It doesn't own the airplanes or the runways, but it steps back and makes sure everything is flowing properly and efficiently.
And what it ends up meaning is that Texas can't share electricity or get electricity from the rest of the country very easily. It's possible, but it's not a very simple thing to have happen.
Like there's blackouts, but you can't just say, oh, shoot, like we need to get electricity from wherever, Colorado or someone.
Right, right. And this is not always a bad thing. I mean, like one of the things where you see benefit to having this setup is that it ends up driving up the cost of electricity sometimes, which means that there's a big impetus to build more electricity, which is a big part of why Texas has led the nation in wind development over the last couple of decades, because they have all of this, you know, incentive to build more power generation. Usually they're thinking for the peak of summer, which is a really great time to get wind power in Texas. They're not really planning for the peak of winter.
70 to 80 of them, about 10%, are physically offline right now, physically are not working.
So you've seen, I'm sure, some of the stuff around blaming wind power for these outages. And
right,
that's,
like wind turbines still working in Antarctica, right?
Well, I mean, wind turbines still work in Minnesota.
Right,
we get a large portion of our electricity from wind turbines. And part of that is because Minnesota has, you know, you can, you know how you can like buy a car and upgrade all these upgrade packages? Well, the same is true of wind turbines, and all the ones in Minnesota have the cold weather package installed, which includes things like heaters and de-icing and stuff like that. And Texas did not.
Now, we had rotating outages in 1989 and 2011. After 2011, the Public Utility Commission recommended updating, winterizing these power plants, but it was not mandated. The reason why it was seen as a costly mandate for a weather event that we really only see every 10 to 20 years. Of course, we're in one right now, and that decision seems rather obvious. We have reached out.
But, you know, it's not just wind, right? When you were looking at the data coming in over this weekend about where the outages were happening in Texas, a far greater proportion of their lost generation capacity was coming from natural gas.
They're not going to pull power from first responders, you know, fire stations, police departments, hospitals. And so that gives them very limited capability to take some people offline, put them back online, take other people offline and keep rolling. So instead,
there's other places that demand that natural gas. So there was a lot of natural gas going to heating, and there was not enough natural gas left for some of those power plants.
Got it. And so then, if this is a wake-up call, I guess I'm wondering just who exactly is it a wake-up call to?
Yeah, it's I'd say it's definitely a wake-up call to the people that are running the electric systems, because some of this is going to have to be about, like, you know, your infrastructure upgrades. I wrote a book about the electric grid about a decade ago, and one of the things that I learned from that is that our infrastructure, electrical infrastructure all over the U.S. is very, very old.
Documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act show that before the campfire, PG&E knew that 49 of the steel towers that carry the electrical line that failed needed to be replaced entirely.
There's a bunch of old houses in America that are still operating on knob and tube wiring because there's not a big incentive to spend your renovation money on something like that if it's still working. And until it catastrophically fails.
Alaska, Minnesota, Boston, Chicago, New York, they don't lose power when it gets cold because they build their facilities differently. The question is, are we willing to do that?
And it's the same thing with the grid as a whole.
Yeah, and again, when we're talking about catastrophic events, that also means that in a shifting climate, when you might see catastrophic weather events smushed even closer together, it's an even bigger deal, right? Maggie Kurth there in Minnesota. By the way, what are we talking about there? Are you in positive territory yet?
Oh, no, it's actually great today. It's like 10 degrees, and I went outside, and I was like, oh, warmth.
Okay. All right. Maggie Kurth from our friends at 538. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Since being inaugurated, President Biden has barely left the White House. He made a quick trip to his home in Delaware, but otherwise he's remained in D.C.
I wanted to go up because there's a lot going on in Wisconsin. It's cold as the devil up there. They got a lot.
That changed yesterday when Biden went to Milwaukee, capped with a town hall on CNN.
What is the plan and recommendation to get students back into the brick and mortar buildings? As a parent of four children, I find it imperative that they get back to school as safely as possible.
My mother would say, God bless you, son. No purgatory for you. Four kids home. I really mean it. And by the way, the loss of being able to be in school is having significant impact on the children and parents as well.
He was there to pitch his plan for nearly $2 trillion in COVID relief. Biden's team has said he wants to do this more, take his plans outside the Beltway, get constituents fired up. After all, polling shows most Americans actually agree with the idea of a big rescue package. So what's the difference between this week and last week? Why not do it then? Well, this week, Biden is the only show in town.
As the rioters reached the top of the stairs, they were within 100 feet of where the vice president was sheltering with his family.
While Pence was locked in a room just outside the Senate chamber, and as that mob was closing in, Donald Trump took to Twitter to attack Pence for not having courage, for not having the courage to overturn the election.
As the world relived the events of January 6th during last week's impeachment trial of former President Trump, that was the sole thing people in Washington were talking about, was how did this happen? How dangerous have the last few months been for democracy? And who should be held responsible? Biden is betting that Congress is ready to focus on what he wants to do, COVID relief. But with Trump's acquittal, the end could actually be a long way off. Remember, 43 Republican senators voted to acquit Trump, many of them saying, just because this isn't the Senate's business, he's a private citizen now. Well, yesterday, a member of Congress sued Trump as a private citizen. And what happens next could continue to shape how we view the events of January 6th. Let's go to ABC senior investigative reporter Aaron Katursky. Aaron, what's happening here?
Well, Brad, there is going to be a lawsuit against the former president, along with his attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and two extremist groups, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. And it was filed by one of the most powerful Democrats in the House, Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi, the chair of the House Homeland Security Committee. And he said Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, openly encouraged this kind of litigation.
President Trump is still liable for everything he did while he was in office as an ordinary citizen, unless the statute of limitations is run, still liable for everything he did while he's in office. Didn't get away with anything yet.
In his speech on the Senate floor following former President Trump's acquittal, McConnell said, "We have a criminal justice system in this country, we have civil litigation, and former presidents are not immune from either."
I saw the moving of the furniture blocking the doors. I heard the shot where a citizen was killed.
And so Chairman Thompson appears to have taken McConnell up on the offer, and he is saying that Trump, Giuliani, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers all conspired to incite the riot of January 6th, and in doing so, violated the Ku Klux Klan Act.
Wait, what is the Ku Klux Klan Act?
It's actually, in some ways, almost drafted for this situation, even though
this dates to Reconstruction. It was passed in 1871, and it is a law that made it illegal to conspire to do anything that would keep Congress from doing its business.
There were marauders who were attempting to block it.
And initially, it was meant to protect Southern state senators from constituents who might have been angry in the aftermath of the Civil War.
This particular statute has virtually never been invoked since then, which I think speaks volumes about how extraordinary the events of January 6th were.
But here, Benny Thompson believes it was written just for this moment because he said that Trump and Giuliani and the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys all tried to keep Congress from doing its business, from certifying the election results, and he said they nearly succeeded.
But Aaron, like, what is the likelihood that anyone would actually get held responsible for something that just seemed to snowball like it did? Because even the whole point impeachment managers were making was, yeah, there wasn't one moment where someone said, let's go kidnap some members of Congress. Let's go storm the Capitol. That moment didn't exist. That's why they had to build their case, and Trump got acquitted.
And they built it through video and audio. But what were they missing? What kinds of things might a civil lawsuit in federal court unearth? What about emails or what about text messages or recollections of private conversations that could be subpoenaed through a discovery process?
Ultimately, the impeachment trial was a political process, and it led to a political result. This suit is being filed in a court of law where the rule of law applies.
And so lawyers, assuming this all goes forward, and you can bet the former president's going to do whatever he can to try and derail it, but assuming it goes forward, lawyers could really try to unearth documents and emails, electronic communications, anything that would build out a fuller narrative.
There's still more evidence that the American people need and deserve to hear.
And in that spirit, Brad, this may not be the only thing to try and build a more full accounting of what went on January 6th.
Well, and that's the thing, Aaron, is this just a Democratic member of the House, several Democratic members of the House, saying, you know, we didn't see the result we wanted over in the Senate. We're going to keep this in the American consciousness right now. Like, we just want to keep beating this drum. Or are there things they think they can get out of these roads that they didn't get in the impeachment trial? Is it just about attention, or are there actual outcomes they're looking for?
Brad, we're about to get our first hearing involving the response of Capitol Police. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she wants to invoke a 9/11 style commission to thoroughly investigate what happened on January 6th and make recommendations for how to prevent it in the future.
And a few minutes after Donald Trump's tweet, he didn't reach out to check on the vice president's safety. He called a senator to ask about delaying the certification.
And while that may not come with a constitutional or a legal punishment, it could certainly help shape former President Trump's legacy if the narrative that the Democrats have presented holds, that he knew full well that this insurrection was underway and did nothing to stop it. The lawyers are fairly confident that as a private citizen now, he cannot use the shield of his office.
About an hour passed before I was able to really know what was going on and to get out of the gallery area into what I thought was a more secure area that turned out to be a hot spot for coronavirus.
Congressman Thompson says that as an individual, he was harmed by what went on January 6th and is entitled to these financial awards from a court that would come directly out of former President Trump's pocket.
Wow. And to the point about just the number of ways in which you can see this. Is it an impeachable offense? Is it a criminal offense? A civil one? This congressman filed a civil lawsuit with the assistance of the NAACP, who says this should also be seen as an attempt to disenfranchise black voters. So, like you said, Aaron, the question of which legacy will be cemented as this all plays out. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brad.
Next time on Start Here, no one in France ever thought they'd be relying on an obscure American to keep Notre Dame intact. Our team goes inside the cathedral after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/starthere today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/starthere.
With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November, and while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I remember flipping on the TV in April 2019 and seeing something I never imagined. Notre Dame, the cathedral, burning.
The pictures from Paris at this hour. Just catastrophic.
It was just heartbreaking to watch. The ladders were not tall enough. The hoses were not strong enough.
To the point where I was like, oh my God, is the Notre Dame Cathedral literally about to burn to the ground before my eyes?
The spire of the 850-year-old Notre Dame Cathedral collapsed, caving in the roof, engulfing this historic landmark in flames.
Since then, it's become difficult to describe just how close it came to being demolished and how difficult it will be to rebuild. Well, guess what? Yesterday, ABC's foreign correspondent James Longman got an exclusive tour inside, and he found that the future of Notre Dame might actually rest on the work of a dead American professor. I want to go to James now, because James, I was not ready for this. I was expecting to hear, hey, yeah, I'm here, there's patching, there's cement working happening behind me. And yet to hear you, this sounds actually a lot more complicated and really a lot more urgent. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I mean, actually, it was a total surprise to us. We were led inside the Notre Dame compound.
You go through the shower.
You have to go through this kind of decontamination process. It's like getting on some kind of starship because of the lead.
And we're actually not even allowed into this part because they're so worried about lead inhalation. You need a specialized mask in order to go in.
The amount of lead that melted that was lining the roof into the cathedral, basically the reason why that roof collapsed.
200 tons, à peu près. About 200 tons of lead on that roof.
That poisonous substance is everywhere now. It's embedded in the stone, in the metal, in the woodwork, and it's everywhere in the air. So you have to wear these kind of Tyvek suits marching around.
Right, Notre Dame.
And we were led, not first into the cathedral itself, but to a tent nearby.
So here, what they've done here is they've recuperated everything they found, all the bits of woodwork, all the carpentry, the mason they needed to retrieve that was found scattered along the floor of Notre Dame after the fire.
Where the chief archaeologist is busy with her team trying to piece together the pieces of stone that fell all that distance, some 30 metres from the roof of Notre Dame.
Il y en a en haut et il y en a en bas.
It's basically an enormous puzzle.
And put them together and work out where they went originally in order to put these stones back in to rebuild the roof.
An archaeologue architect American, Andrew Talon.
Andrew Talon.
Andrew Talon.
And the guy behind it is an American. His name is Andrew Talon, Belgian-American, I should say. And he absolutely loved Notre Dame. He was an art historian, he was a professor at Vassar, and he dedicated his life to Notre Dame.
It happens in 2014, thereabout, 12. Did a plan of Notre Dame, and that's the one you're using.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
Sadly, he died in 2018, so he never saw the fire. But here's the plans that they're using now in Notre Dame to try to rebuild the church. And it's pretty extraordinary. The head archaeologist said to me, here's the only plans that survive, because for that specific part, they don't have any others.
So the Americans rebuilt Notre Dame, is essentially what they're saying.
Exactly.
But so why does that matter so much? If, like, obviously this is not going to, it's not all going to be original wood and everything. Like, there are parts that just got burned. What is the problem with having, like, this stone there or that stone there?
Well, they have to work out whether or not these particular stones are structurally sound.
C'est plus la chute qui a abîmé les blocs, finalement.
It's more falling from the roof that's the worst thing, but it might have cracked
a block rather than the fire necessarily.
So they have to take all these out, clean them properly, get rid of all the lead, and then either get them into a position where they can be put back into the church or use them with this cutting-edge laser technology to then form new pieces of stone, using them as a model, to then make new stone that can be used to rebuild Notre Dame. So it's a long, long process.
So they found about 70 blocks. But they're probably only going to have about 10 of the originals that make it into this arch.
And they've only just started really piecing these bits of stone together because the main part of the project so far over the last 2 years has actually been just to try to stabilise the building.
One of the weakest parts of the whole structure is between these two towers, and that was what was really worrying onlookers on that night and has worried engineers and architects ever since.
Still not completely secure because of the roof, the gaping hole in the roof, which I managed to climb up on the roof and had a look down through the big hole that spire collapsing left.
You can see the charred ends of what was once the oak vault that kept this part of the roof in place.
And they're still working to secure the building now.
Well, and so then, what will this end up looking like, James? Like, what is the plan? Is it, are people going to go to Paris in several years and think, wow, that's Notre Dame? Or is it just going to look like something different?
They have tried very much to keep to the original plan. There was a kind of a competition, if you like, for different, you know, architectural designs of what the new Notre Dame would look like. But it's actually now going to look exactly the same as it did the day before it went up in flames. But there have been big delays because this thing is so complicated.
They've got something like 10,000 separate pieces of wood they need to sort.
They had originally wanted to get this thing properly roofed in order for visitors to be able to come back by the Olympics in Paris, which are due to be held in 2024. No one here is saying that that's not going to happen, but they're very, very cautious about saying that it is. It does feel as though it's going to slip. But it is a huge symbol of national pride for the French.
You're saying that if you walk past it, you wouldn't know there was anything wrong. The facade still looks as incredible as ever.
And so it was a real pleasure, actually, to see all these different workers coming together with their different skills to try to rebuild their national emblem.
Fascinating stuff. All right, James Longman, they're in Paris. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
And one last thing. The filing was 100 pages long, but a judge's ruling could have just been summed up in three words. No take backsies. We told you about this case a while ago. Revlon, the makeup company, needed a ton of financial help and took out nearly $1 billion in loans from these outside lenders. Revlon hired Citigroup as its banker, so Citigroup's job was to make Revlon's interest payments. But one day last year, instead of sending the usual $8 million in interest, the lenders see that Citigroup has sent them $800 million. Well, a judge has now ruled that's the end of it. The lenders that held on to the money get to keep about $500 million. Now, there are rules saying if you mistakenly pay someone, you're entitled to get it back. The reason that doesn't work here, the judge said, is the rule only counts if it's a clear mistake at the time. And the judge says that if you're in the lender's shoes, this clearly looked like Citigroup was deciding to pay off Revlon's debt. They were giving you all your money back at once. In fact, here's a quote from the ruling. To believe that Citibank, one of the most sophisticated financial institutions in the world, had made a mistake that had never happened before to the tune of nearly $1 billion, that would have been borderline irrational, meaning the lenders now get to keep the money, Citigroup is furious, and a struggling makeup company is free and clear with its best financial foundation in years. Does this mean that Revlon can just give away all of its makeup for free for, like, at least a few months? Seems like what it should mean, right? Remember, Start Here is smart speaker friendly. That means you can get us playing at home while you're making your coffee, putting on your makeup, whatever it is. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.